coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and welcome! Welcome back to the live show. So sorry for the pre-recorded episodes the last couple weeks. I have been out on the road. I assure you, though, much of that is coming to an end. Very soon you will be hearing so much more live content from here at the home studio, as well as live content. Our next live show is coming to you from the Falk Monster Festival in Falk, Arkansas. Our good friend Craig Woolheater, founder of the Texas Bigfoot Museum, is helping put that on. We are one of the sponsors there. We will be doing live streaming all day long, just like we did from the Texas Bigfoot Festival. Great response from that. We had over 300,000 responses on social media to that. And in addition to that, folks, just so you know, we are now officially, because of you and sharing the show and everything else, over 5,000 followers on Facebook. So we have almost 1,000 involved active members of our group, and well over 5,000 people, more people who follow the show's page than who like the show's page, which means more people actively want to see what we're doing pop up in their feed than just want to casually follow us. That's great stuff. So keep it up. Keep sharing the show. Keep checking it out online and sharing it with friends, family, everything else. So here in just a minute, we are going to be getting to Lester Velez. He is the author of The Unknown Other and the Existential Proposition of Alien Contact. He is also the co-founder of OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. He is a good friend of our friend Daniel Allen Jones, who is our guest in the second half, as well as our friend and guest and the person who put me under hypnotic regression in an episode, Terry Lovelace. So very, very much forward, looking forward to the conversation this evening during the live segment with Les Velez, talking about his time as a MUFON field investigator, his involvement with MUFON, and his co-founding of OPUS, and exactly what the mission of the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support is all about. We will be getting to Les right after we get done with our news of the week. News of the week is, of course, brought to you by the good old Facebook folks. Stop on by, join the Curious Realm group for the conversation. There's a great video from Mike Turber today of 5x5 News, who did some great coverage of the UFO UAP hearing that happened. We were playing that just beforehand. We'll be covering a couple of those things with Les this evening and what his opinion is on those. From listener Will Liam out of expressnews.com, refugees in Texas. Which countries do they come from? Not a lot of people realize that we get a lot of refugees here in Texas. Out of the Daily Beast, anti-snowflake Jordan Peterson quits Twitter because he, quote, can't hack the insults. Out of fizz.org, researchers developed a new 3D printed shape memory alloy with superior super elasticity. Out of dailymail.co.uk, veterans were told to stay quiet after seeing UFO in the Middle East. Tons of UFO news today because of the hearing, actually. Out of Wall Street Journal, an exclusive, China Eastern black box points to intentional nosedive. Apparently, the China Eastern plane that went down was put into an intentional nosedive. I'm sure we will hear more of that as things come out. And breaking news out of Bloomberg today, Elon Musk says Twitter must prove their bot claims for the $44 billion deal to proceed. That is just some of the news there in our Facebook group, Curious Realm. Stop on by, check us out, curiousrealm.com. while you were online checking that out, make sure to stop on by the website of our amazing guest, WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is your home for unlimited Wi-Fi for the entire family, anywhere at home or abroad. Anywhere that you have cell phone signal, you will have unlimited connectivity. Curious Realm is streamed live to our website every week via WebWorks Wireless. I have yet to hit a data cap at 20 gigs plus of uploaded data per month. Stop on by, check them out, webworkswireless.com, as well as our other sponsor, Secret to Everything, our amazing guest, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. Make sure to stop on by, secrettoeverything.com. They are your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion. Speaking of consciousness expansion, folks, our guest today, Les Velez, many, many years spent working with MUFON hand in hand, coming up with protocols for field investigators, things like the abductee team, the experiencer team, which our good friend and guest Sev Talk is a member of, as well as co-founder of the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. Welcome to the show, Les Velez. How are you doing today, sir?
Great, Christopher. How are you doing today?
I am more than fantastic and very excited to have you on tonight.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and I look forward to our chat.
You know, Terry Lovelace is a very, very good friend of this podcast and of me personally. We have numerous conversations off air, and I remember when he was coming aboard with you guys and telling me about y'all and the amazing work that you guys are doing over at Opus. One of the things that we try to do on this show, I mean, of course, in my heart of hearts, in the fabric of my soul, Les, I am a believer. All right. But like Carl Sagan said, with great claims come the need for great evidence, come the need for higher scientific standard, and also come the need of support. Because something that we talk about with people like Terry Lovelace all the time is how hard it is to come forward with a story like his, especially if you're in a position like his, you know, where he was an active lawyer for years. Like, that could have jeopardized cases, all kinds of things. So the fact that you have come out with the Organization for not just Paranormal Understanding, but support of those who have experienced, I think, is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Thank you very much, Chris. And one of the things, you know, as you said, that people that are having these types of experiences oftentimes do not know who to talk to, or that they start to talk to people, these people feel that they might be crazy. And it's a very negative type reaction that in a lot of cases happens to these people. And so you can understand why people are reticent about coming out with their stories. However, you know, this was something that we realized very early on. Opus was founded in 1994 by my co-founder, Dr. Eugene Lipson, who's subsequently has passed away, unfortunately. He was a wonderful man. And, you know, we recognize the fact that, you know, you need to be able to support these people. And you know, based on the cases, when I first started with MUFON in 1991, most of the cases that I investigated were not only sightings, but turned out to be abduction type cases, people saying that they had contact with non-human intelligences. And so, you know, what do these people do? They can't turn to their family members in a lot of cases. They can't turn to clergy. They can't go to a regular psychologist or psychiatrist, because most of the mental health community is not open, or you know, they don't have the experience with working with people like that. So we saw that there was a need for this type of an organization to be set up, where we can support these people with an online support group or a referral to hypnotherapists that are familiar with the topic, or mental health practitioners. So, Yeah, this is it's an incredible phenomena. And we've found through various studies that these people do not have a psychopathology. They're not crazy. They're not fantasy prone. You know, all the debunkers talk about all these various things, you know, whether they're it's sleep paralysis. Well, 2/3 of all the cases, whether in a bedroom or not, did not involve sleep paralysis. Fantasy proneness, as I mentioned, is not a factor. The American Psychological Association, nor any mainstream psychological diagnostic system, has either ratified or even proven such a diagnostic. And then fantasy proneness, as I mentioned, we found was not a factor in the omega-3 study. I don't know if I said fantasy proneness twice. What I meant was false memory syndrome was the American Psychological Association finding that was not ratified or proven. So anyway, the bottom line is there's something happening. And then the big question is, what is it? You know, what the hell is going on with these people? And it's a phenomena that is so widespread. It's just mind-boggling. I mean, you know, the Roper Organization back in 92 published a report that was set up by Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and funded by Robert Bigelow. And at that time, they said 6 million people in the United States had experiences like this. Well, if you move forward in time and understand that this is a worldwide phenomena, and we do have people in our support group from literally all over the world. We have them from Africa, from Australia, from, Europe. So my latest theory on all this is that we've all had an experience, but most of us don't consciously recall it. Mm. And I've been told that I've been on board a ship twice. It was a support group meeting that I had. And a person said, "I've seen you before." And I said, "Where? At a UFO conference?" "No, I saw you on board the craft." I kind of blew it off. I certainly didn't have any conscious recollection at that time. And it was a year and a half, 2 years later that somebody said the same thing and said, "Yeah, you were sitting on a bench on this craft and you were naked and you were freaking out. And they told me to go over to you to calm you down." So after that one, I said, "Okay, I'm going to go get regressed." And I went and had 3 separate regressions, and I found out nothing along those lines. However, I had multiple past lives. And one of the stories in my book by Adam Burns talks about his conversations, you know, telepathically with these aliens that talk about reincarnation and that it's a universal factor. It's just the way the universe works. Mm. And so, you know, our energy, our souls, if you will, you know, don't die when our physical body dies. We go on and on and on.
Yeah. And that is something that we proclaim and talk about on this show regularly, is the fact of, by all physics, energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be changed. The fact that right now, despite our distance apart from each other, Les, we are sharing an electron shell by all rules of physics. My kid 25 feet away from me in his room, we're sharing one, and I'm sharing one with my dad hundreds of miles away, and you thousands of miles away. You know, this table that's underneath me is just a repulsion of electrons that I'm feeling. It's all 90% empty space. So, for me, it's more strange that, like you said, that people haven't had one than have. And we had a comment by a gentleman who is what... We have a lot of TIs, targeted individuals, that listen to this program. And he just got finished saying that the TI community could use this kind of therapy, could use this kind of just open-hearted listening. Because like you said, You would think that going somewhere with people of like mind, even growing up in the same family, that you might be able to go to somebody. Frequently you're not. And we just had that discussion last week with Mary Helen Hensley, talking about the bad side of NDEs, you know, near-death experience, and people who come back. And you always hear about the bubblegum fantasy and people who go to the other side and they see a light and they come back and my life has changed and I have a purpose. There are a lot of people that is not the case. There are a lot of people that when they have the quote extraterrestrial experience, my friend, they are petrified stiff. It's not an enjoyable experience, much less something that you want to quote write home about.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this this phenomena is the fact that, yes, there's like three stages to it. The beginning stage is definitely traumatic. There's no question about it. It takes you out of any normalcy that you can possibly think of.
Would you say that is the status quo of experiences that you've seen in your many, many years, is that most of them are traumatic to begin with? Doesn't matter.
Yeah. The majority are traumatic in the beginning. Then, depending upon, you know, the frequency that then occurs afterwards, it starts to phase into a real acceptance of what's going on. And then things change as far as the perception of the phenomena, where it becomes a more loving situation in a lot of cases. It's a more communicative type of a situation. And then in the final stages, when it stops, it's almost like the Stockholm syndrome, where people say, well, how come? How come they're not coming back for me? Or they're not talking to me anymore?
Yeah.
And what we've found through various studies, we have one of the studies on our website. It's called the Omega-3 study that I actually was funded by MUFON, that I was the facilitator for it. And we talked about, the fact that we had 71 people that claimed that they had contact with non-human intelligences.
Wow.
And compared them to 50. Yeah, if you go all the way, scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll see the Omega-3 study. Yeah, it's all the way at the bottom. Compared to 51 that were a control group. And it's amazing that these 70 to 80% of these people want these experiences to continue. It's only that minority that wanted to stop because it continues to be a negative experience.
Interesting. I share my experience regularly, which was not with any extraterrestrial craft. I love the fact that you are the organization for paranormal understanding and support, and especially understanding the fact that so many of these topics bridge together and are connected in a fractal way, and really in a spoke of a wheel way. Mine was a paranormal experience, honestly, like in church. And when I got amongst people who you think would be of like mind, like I can't think of anybody more of like mind than actively entering the seminary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And going and sharing my experience, to see the number of people that looked at me with like saucered eyes and went, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You hit the nail on the head, really, with the when you say paranormal, because it encompasses so many different things, whether it's spiritual, whether it's Kundalini awakening, poltergeist activity,
sure,
near-death experiences. I mean, all these are interconnected. And it's funny, as it turns out, the majority of things that we are dealing with seem to be in the nature of contact with non-human intelligences. Mm-hmm. One of the things we found, we just finished the first phase of the Omega 4 project, which I'm doing now with a psychologist friend of mine. And what we did is we sent this questionnaire out to therapists that are working with experiencers. And what we found was that the number one thing that people were dealing with were the grays. Okay. The second thing that they were dealing with are orbs. The third thing was interdimensionals. And the fourth thing were ghosts. And so you have quite an interesting mix of entities, if you will, that are being talked about. And the one thing that it involves with the grays oftentimes are tall grays, the short grays, of course, mantid type people, like reptoids, Nordics, and military. And so there's I've often thought about the fact that all these different races are utilizing the grays. Is there some kind of a large supermarket out there or an Apple store that sells grays to be used to abduct people? Because we're a violent race. And I've had people tell me from our support group that they bit people, the grays. One person totally ripped an arm off of one. And so it's amazing. It's amazing that they all seem to be utilizing these basically biological robotic type things that most people talk about that, you know, they're not like a reptoid or a mantid type of a creature, but a special utilitarian type of a creature.
Okay. Okay. Much more of a specially built apparatus that they bring themselves through. And you know, with that in mind, I'd like to, especially with your years of work as a MUFON field investigator, as a co-founder of Opus, I'd like to address a couple of the things that were brought up in today's intelligence briefing, really the first ever public intelligence briefing regarding UAPs. People are regularly read in on this topic in Congress. But this is the first time that there was ever a Senate hearing where there were numerous people and there were cameras and they were asking questions about UAPs. And I thought it was very interesting that at one point, they made it very clear that some of these things may not be physical. They say the great majority of these sightings are physical and can be explained, but some of them, we don't really know what they are. And not only do we not know what they are, but they don't seem to be something physical. They seem to be something ethereal that's there. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that it's a multitude of different things. Just as, you know, are these things extraterrestrial? Are they interdimensional? Are they time travelers? Are they our military? Certainly interdimensional craft would certainly seem to be non-physical. As a matter of fact, I had a case that's in the book of a couple that were picnicking in a state park near north of Santa Cruz, California, and they noticed this object over the ocean, and this bright light basically at first, and as it got closer, they noticed that it was a triangular craft about the size of a small Learjet, and this thing proceeded into a canyon behind them, and they noticed another light over the ocean, and this craft finally got over their heads, and it was the same type of a craft. And the first one, they were looking at it. The second one, they felt it was looking at them, and they became frightened at that point.
Oh, wow.
This happened five more times, and these craft were sitting in this canyon, just kind of fluctuating, the butterfly effect, you know, where they hover and seem to go back and forth. And all of a sudden, they all went up on their side, and it's like they went around a corner, but there was no corner. They just totally disappeared. And then this couple also had missing time in the process. They when they came out of the park, the last thing they remembered was that they were coming out of there, and they ended up at a restaurant, which was only 5 to 10 minutes away from where they were, but it was 3 hours later, and they had no recollection of how they got there. So, I mean, you know, these are just some of the things that I have about 25 stories from experiencers in the book that are quite interesting and shows a lot of the different things that are possible when people have contact with these intelligences.
Well, and I find it interesting because I also choose the term experiencer, and I don't think I'd really thought about it as deeply as you had. When you go through your learned explanation as to why you use the term experiencer after your many years of field investigation, dealing with abductees, dealing with close encounters of first, second, third, fourth kind, you came to use the term experiencer because it was literally the most politically correct.
Yeah, I feel it's neutral. Because, you know, abduction has a negative connotation. Contact has a very positive or a positive type of a connotation, where experiencer, you know, it kind of opens up your possibilities. It can be either or both, or, you know, so that's why I kind of use it right now. I don't want to offend anybody. You know?
Well, and it's also, I mean, for me, I use it because of the fact that, yes, I am an experiencer. It may not be a UFO, but it was definitely unidentified presence that I was there, not just once, but numerous times in my life. And what I know in my life to be the presence of God, that just happens to be the filter through which that came to me. You know, had I had a different filter growing up, it may not have been God. It may have been a totally different concept.
Sure. And that's very important. That we do filter things through our upbringing, how, you know, the experiences that we have when we're young. I mean, one of the things that we found is that there's been, for a lot of experiencers, there's been a childhood trauma of some sort that has gone on, which caused them to dissociate in a way. And that dissociation seems to open people up to having these types of experiences. There's the second part of the Omega 4 study that we're doing. We will go out to the clients of these therapists to get more information about the experiencers, because I think it's something that we're trying to really find ways to help these people. And if we can find a quote unquote formula, if you will, that will make these people have a better understanding and also to be more comfortable with what's going on. I think this points to the fact that I think this has been going on since, you know, man has been present on this planet. We're not at the top of the food chain. This whole structure has been going on for millennia. We are just kind of waking up to it in a way, or some of us are waking up to it in a way. There's many people, you know, that get up in the morning, have breakfast, go to work, come home in the afternoon, have dinner, watch some TV, go to bed. Next day they do the same thing over and over and over again, which, you know, that's not a bad thing. I mean, they got to take care of their family. They got to do, you know, put food on a table. And so it's important. But when you have something like this happen, it shakes up your worldview.
Yeah.
And people's worldview changes dramatically after this.
Yeah.
You know, they come back with a message that, hey, we need to be better stewards of the planet. We need to take care of our air and our waters, and we need to be better to one another. We need to be more loving. And you know, these are all wonderful, wonderful traits, you know, or statements that they come back with, these ideas, I should say. You know, how bad can that be? But I mean, there's a school of thought that all these aliens are bad, you know, and then there's some people that feel they're all good. Well, I think you need to be careful with that. I think we have, just like we have here on Earth, we have good people and bad people. And I think the same thing is going on up there, even within the species, because I've heard reptilians, you know, oh, people say they're all bad. Well, I've had people say that they've had wonderful relationships with the reptilians.
Were they evil people?
Yeah.
No. Just asking honestly.
Yeah, no, I don't know. No, the bottom line is that the experience was positive for them, I think we just have to be careful in characterizing, them as either all good or all bad.
Absolutely.
And I think you have to go with your gut. When this type of a thing goes, for me, it's always been my gut, you know, telling me if it feels okay, then I go forward. If it doesn't, I back off. We don't understand, you know, we don't have a definitive answer on all of this. There's no question about it. You know, scientifically, we're trying to, you know, maybe with this UAP task force, they're going to try to do this, you know, more scientifically and try to understand what's going on. But, I think that, I had lunch a couple of years ago before COVID shut everything down. With Terry Lovelace and Lou Elizondo. And Lou was there interviewing Terry for the Unidentified show that was on the History Channel, which never got aired. For some reason, it never got aired. And so I just heard the other day that Lou said something, because somebody asked him, well, what do you think about this abduction stuff? And he says, well, we have investigated military personnel being abducted. Well, I'm just wondering if it was Terry. But then he said he couldn't talk about it anymore. That, you know, based on his security clearance, he can't say anything more about it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is the thing that's so frustrating. And you know, talking about that congressional hearing today, that there was a lot of good answers, or excuse me, good questions, but a lot of crappy answers.
And a lot of very, very well phrased answers.
And
a couple things as we were discussing in our pre-show just discussion that were a little bit disturbing. One of them that we played in the clip earlier was them saying, like, so what are the repercussions of anybody spreading misinformation about or disseminating conspiracy theories about UFOs, UAPs, anything like that? And they literally said, well, there are none, and you guys should think about that. Maybe you guys should write a law.
Oh, God, no.
And that was one of those, like, okay, there's the opening. That and the fact that one of the first things out was they might be a national security threat, but yet at the same time, when taken to task by the good senator about Malmstrom, one of the biggest known incidents ever where, like, an orb above a military base knocked out the power and functionality of 10 nuclear warheads, like back in the 60s, 70s, you know.
Well, as a matter of fact,
they were we didn't look into that. Like, what do you mean you didn't look into that? You're just now, you're saying that they're possibly a threat to national security, but you didn't look into that known case.
Right. Well, you know, Robert Salas had a press conference at the National Press Club this past year, and talking about that incident. And I also met Robert and his wife at the MUFON Symposium in Las Vegas, because he was one of the speakers there. And I had made a presentation to the Experiencer group on Saturday morning of the show, of the symposium. And he came up to me after, and he says, "Can I speak to you afterwards?" And I said, "Sure." And so I had a table there where I was hawking the book. And he sits down with his wife, and they start telling me about his experience. They, both of them, had been abducted, and they both had actually a positive experience.
Wow.
And his wife became a healer after that experience. And this is another thing that goes on with people that have these experiences. Some of them are healed. Some of them become healers.
We just talked with Kathleen Martin.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And the fact that many people, after their experiences, it's like they are participating in a higher vibrational level.
Mm-hmm. And people become psychic, have psychic abilities afterwards, or after a near-death experience. I mean, one of the things that actually started Opus on its path was I got written up in the Monterey Coast Weekly paper as, you know, talking about the things that I was doing with MUFON. Mm-hmm. And this woman who was also written up in it contacted me afterwards. She says, "I want to find out what's going on with my brainwaves when I'm in contact with these off-earthly entities." And so I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And scratching my head to see how I could possibly help her. And then she said she was working with an emergency room doctor down in Carmel. And so that's when the bells started to go off. And I have a doctor friend, Dr. Eugene Lipson, who subsequently became the co-founder of Opus with me. And he was interested in contacting other doctors that were interested in the phenomena. So I called him up. I said, "Let's go down there and talk to this lady." So we did. We went down to her home, and we walked in, and on the wall, there was a picture of her standing on the back of a rather large vessel. And I asked her, I says, "What's this all about?" And she says, "Oh yeah, that's when I was down in the Caribbean helping these treasure finders." And I said, "You were how did you help these treasure finders?" She says, "Well, I was in contact with the captain of the galleon that had gone down."
Oh, wow.
So anyway, that started the afternoon off, and we found out that she had a near-death experience and became psychic after that incident. So anyway, we came away that afternoon saying, "How can we help people like this?" And that's when Opus was hatched. And then in 1994, we officially became a 501c3 nonprofit recognized by the good old IRS. So,
and that's what I love, is that you guys are out there doing this work for the right reasons. You're out there gathering data and just recording experience to the best detail that you can, which is really all you can do. You know, one of the things that we mention on this show all the time, I have people whenever I'm on the road, or people that I know of, I guess, normal brain wavelength. Got a lot of friends. They aren't all on that wavelength, you know, of conversation. And they'll ask me, like, "What, man, like, why did you have that person on the other day talking about this, what they would think is crazy thing, you know, crazy experience that they had, or abduction or experience with the paranormal?" And I'm like, "Man, if I didn't believe my experience, I don't know where my life would be."
Yeah, you would be having a hard time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's literally a part of how I define myself, and has been since the day it happened. Now, granted, that defining of myself has changed over time, much mm-hmm. like you said, and much like Sev has said whenever Sev Talk has come on. And I love the fact that she is out as an advocate and part of the experiencer contact group, because she really can attest to that. Listen, my experiences were scary when they started too.
Mm-hmm.
They are in a different place now. I'm in a different place now. Spiritually, I'm able to do this now because of these experiences.
Yes. No, I mean, it's this whole thing is a spiritual journey. That's the way I characterize this whole thing. It's a spiritual journey. It's bringing us to a whole nother level, okay, that if the entire population of this planet were of this mind, then we wouldn't have the wars that are going on. We wouldn't have the famine that's going on. We would be able to breathe the air and drink water, clean water, breathe clean air. You know, it's just so much that is wrapped up in this thing. And so this realm that we're dealing with, whether it's interdimensional, whether it's time travelers, whether it's extraterrestrial in nature, there's this drumbeat that's going on for so many people that they need to come out. They need to write books. They need to get on shows. Like your mission right now too is you are an integral part of this process now.
Absolutely.
And what you're doing is so important. So thank you.
Thank you.
For what you're doing and helping to get the word out that there's another way to think, there's another way to act. And, you know, these horrible things that have happened in this country with these mass shootings, you know, the war in the Ukraine, all this is so important. And maybe these UAP hearings and things will start us in some way, shape, or form down a path once we understand perhaps who these people are, because I think they need to understand who's driving these things.
Well, most definitely. And granted, whether they are, and we've had a lot of guests, we've had Mike Turber on since these things started being exposed, talking about whether or not they were known technology being tested, A team, B team style, you know, red team, blue team. It's really curious how the people came aboard the USS Nimitz from the US Air Force and touched US Navy planes and took the data boxes and left with them. Like a totally different branch of the military came and did that. And that was cool.
not cool. Not cool.
Not really normal protocol. Even in, and you know, like Lou Elizondo is a dream interview, regardless of where people stand on him. Because for me, it's one of those. It's interesting how he took videos that were quote declassified, but not declassified for media release. And after releasing them, maintained clearance and yet still became a part of the To the Stars Academy, who then secured the next contract for, you know, researching metamaterials from UAPs.
Yeah.
And those are just curious things to me that I, as an outsider, see. This has been a hobby of mine for 20-something years of my life, less. It has not been an all-encompassing oeuvre as it has for you, you know? And I would like to know, especially, now, granted, This is a big point of opinion, and if you don't want to answer it, I fully respect you. But when I first started down the road of having guests like you on, guests like Mike Turber, Anonymous, stuff like that, I got connected with a gentleman pretty deep in the UFO community who started a media thing in the genre years and years ago. And we became connected, and I asked him to come on the show. This was before we were Curious Realm, and he was like, I like your guests. I like your topics. I would love to come on, but I don't come on and talk about these things anymore.
Uh-huh.
I don't go to conferences and speak anymore. I have lost too many friends.
Huh.
There has been too much that has happened in the background, and began to basically lay out what most people would say were the ground workings of Project Bluebeam. The idea of using a faked alien invasion or a faked alien threat to catalyze mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel with that lurking in the background and that concept? How do you feel about one of the first places that, of course, the intelligence briefing went today was threat? Despite the fact that like they said, they have made no attempt of communication. They said that. They made no attempt to be like, hey, you're in U.S. airspace. Who are you? No attempts. Hi, John. Nice to meet you. Nothing.
Yeah.
So, like, they made zero attempts. Granted, they fired no weapons either, they said. But just given the data at hand and your years of experience, where do you come down on the current, quote, disclosure as it is?
I think that Lou had to take the path of probably the path that would get him the farthest in getting the government to really take a look at this thing.
Well, and getting the most real attention on it that would have hooks.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. If you take Stephen Greer's attitude that they're all wonderful and loving and all of that, then I think that his effort to garner any interest in moving forward with investigating these things would have probably fallen on deaf ears.
Hmm.
I think now utilizing the threat is probably a good way to get the government to move forward, because, you know, I would think that the Maelstrom Air Force Base shutting down the missiles is probably something that you would classify as a threat.
Massive. Like the good senator said, like, hey, I'm no intelligence expert, but I'd say that's a big one.
Yeah.
And if you haven't looked into it, could you?
Yeah. And I think that it's, in one way, it's them showing that they have unique abilities that we don't have.
Sure.
And that they have an intelligence that's beyond what we have as far as their technology. And I think it's important that we try to, you know, understand. Now, the next part of that, which is why I would like to interview Lou Elizondo myself, because I do have an interview series on our website that
indeed
I've interviewed.
You do.
Linda Howe, who's also on our advisory committee.
Preston Dennett.
Yeah. And there he is. And I think they need to talk to experiencers, and I'm sure they're already doing it. Gary Nolan at Stanford and Kid Green have interviewed experiencers and looked at their abilities from a psychic standpoint.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Uh, things of that nature, remote viewing capabilities. But they are talking to experiencers, but it's not in a public domain yet. And there's so many facets of coming out, if you will, because then what is the rest of the population that does not or has not had an experience like that look at these people and say, yeah. Ooh, these people have these abilities and we don't. So should we, you know, you got the white supremacists out there. So now you're going to have the anti-alien people, coming
you run
out.
Straight up into an X-Men equation immediately. Yeah. I hate to make the analogy, but it's so entirely true. And we make the differentiation on the show all the time of the percentage of 80-20. Out of 100% of the population living in America, less than 20% took part in the American Revolution. The other 80% were like, you are a crazy person. Stop what you're doing.
Yeah.
So it's not like we have to convince 90% of minds to this waveform or to this idea that this might be a thing less. We only have to get 1 out of 5. You know, you only got to shoot a 20% average here to actively make a big enough ripple to make a difference, you know. And it's interesting to me how since 2017, that those December footages, I remember being at my family Christmas and pointing at my cousin and going, aha, look, it's on CNN.
Yeah.
And it's been since then that you now hear the media using the terms UFO denier. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that, those typical buzzwords that start coming along. And once again, to hear the words threat come about, yes, it will probably be the easiest gateway to research funding.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Now, one of my other hard questions for you is earlier you mentioned the oh my God, his name just left my head. The good gentleman who once did his work out at Skinwalker Ranch, Robert Bigelow.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Bigelow. What is your take on Bigelow? Have you had a chance to work with him? His interest to me seem extraordinarily genuine, and the findings of some of their team, at least what was made public, are extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that he has a genuine interest. I mean, he professes the fact that we are definitely not alone.
Absolutely.
And that he has a curiosity that he can quench because he has the kind of money he has.
Right.
And so I think he's very genuine. I mean, he spent a bunch of money with MUFON. The Star Team stuff came about because of Robert Bigelow. And
precisely.
And then that fell apart. I think he's trying to collect data and trying to understand what's going on. I mean, he bought the Skinwalker Ranch and then he sold the Skinwalker Ranch. And I think he probably found out some interesting things, which we probably don't know the full story of. And he's in possession of the metamaterials now. So it's unfortunately, the government knows a hell of a lot more than they're telling us. And Bigelow knows a hell of a lot more than the average bear.
Absolutely. Oh, he's got a big picnic basket.
Oh, you betcha. And all we can do, you and I, is do what we're doing and try to peck away at this phenomena as best we can. And come up with, in your case, interesting interviews that bring out more details, and me trying to work with these experiences and trying to better understand them. And that's why I did put the book out to kind of give an overview of the phenomena, you know, from the physical aspects, the psychological aspects, you know, the implants, hybrid programs. Thank you. And then, you know, talk about, certainly in the beginning, I talk about how Opus came about, some of the cases that I worked. And I got the UAP report in there that came out, you know, a year ago, June, mm-hmm. last June.
The
and,
four pages.
Yeah. And the Omega-3 study is in there, too, which gives the full, all the statistics on it.
Which we would definitely love to add to our knowledge vault.
Absolutely.
And I've got the book up there. Like I said, I've purchased two physical copies, one for myself, one so I can give it away, because I'm getting ready to do quite a few live events, things like that. So I want to have some great in-depth books like this to be able to give away at those events, that kind of stuff. Because once again, these things cross all lines, and that's why I love that it's the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, because once again the experiences run the gamut The experiencers run the gamut, and once you've had one, it's amazing how many times you are cursorily connected or end up having others, like you said. Even the opening of the other side of the door to healing, to being a sensitive, to being a conduit to other things for other people is such a beautiful thing. Let everybody know, because we're coming up on our hour with you, and I would love to have you on again and again and again, Les. This was such a great organic conversation tonight.
Great. I loved it. Thank you.
You are welcome back on this show anytime. Open invitation. So.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. We are all about sharing the mission of great places like Opus and people like you. Now, but before I let you go, of course, I'm going to give you the chance for shameless self-promotion.
Of course.
That's what it's really all about, from my days in radio. That's
right.
About the commercial break. But before we do that, how can people begin to process these experiences from your years as a field investigator, from your years on the from helping build the protocols for the experiencer team, for the abductee team, with MUFON? What can people do to begin to accept the experience that may have happened to them that may be holding them back from something in life? And what can they do to be there for somebody who may have experienced, though they don't believe?
Well, I think the one thing they need to understand is they're not alone. And they need an empathetic ear to listen to their stories and not be judgmental. And that's what we give people, a neutral place in the online support group, which has proved to be probably one of the most beneficial things that we have. There's a support button on our website that people can click, and you fill out a very short little form to ask, you know, or tell us what you're looking for, whether it's being added to the support group. There you have it. Or you're looking for, a hypnotherapist, a mental health practitioner, something along those lines. But people need to understand they're not alone, that there are other people having extremely similar experiences that they are having. And once that happens, it's a very calming, stress-reducing type of a situation for them, that they can read in the support group, these experiences that other people are having, and they can ask questions and they'll get answers in a lot of cases. We don't have all the answers, that's for sure. But just know that you're part of a group is and that there's other people having these similar experiences is just so helpful for them to understand that there's an empathetic ear listening to their stories and not being judgmental is so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I said, the fact that there is an actual nonprofit foundation like Opus out there for this less. So beautiful, because I've got tingles and goosebumps right now, because I know what I dealt with. I know what I still deal with, you know, whenever I meet people and we have conversations, and we have deep conversations, and it doesn't detract from the deep conversations that I don't necessarily maybe share that one moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't always share that one moment, Les.
Yeah. Well, I would love to hear your moment. I would definitely love to hear it sometime.
We'll definitely have that conversation, because like I said, I would love to have you on again and again and again.
Okay.
It'll
be my pleasure. It'll be my pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for your time tonight. Before we let you go, let everybody know one last time where they can go to get help, where they can go to get support, where they can go to buy the book, of course, other than the Curious Realm store.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah, basically just go to Opus, our webpage at opusnetwork.org. There's a support button at the top if you're looking for some type of help. And the book, if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see the book right there. You can just click on view on Amazon. And there's the price. If you're a Kindle Prime member, it's free. And the paperback is $20, and the Kindle version is like $9.99. And as I said, all the proceeds from the sale of the book go directly to the nonprofit Opus organization.
I absolutely love that. And like I said, that is why I'm more than happy that I double clicked on my order, because yes, I have a book to give away at a show, and I have a digital copy that I can give to somebody. So
I appreciate that very much.
Any time and always, as I tell many guests, our audience on social media is your audience. Feel free to share any work of Opus there that you like. We would love to have you on whenever you have Opus updates, new research that you are publishing, new research that you are putting out. I wish that we had, unfortunately, we're getting ready to roll the next pre-recorded segment with our mutual friend, Daniel Alan Jones.
Say hi to him for me.
I would love to have a private conversation with you and carry this on further, and most definitely have you on again and again and again, Les.
Anytime. Just email me and we can chat.
You bet. You have a great evening. Everybody, stay tuned through these commercial messages, and we will be hearing from Daniel Alan Jones. We will be talking about the new tunnel at least what some say is a tunnel that was seen on the surface of Mars. We will be talking about that with Daniel Alan Jones coming up here right after these messages. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spigeric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the live show. I'm so happy to be back in the studio. Looks like I will be back in the studio more and more and more. Many, many exciting announcements to come with HC Productions. All kinds of fun stuff. But while you're online checking out everything from our guest this hour, Daniel Allen Jones, and the Vortex.online, make sure to stop on by WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is, of course, our sponsor for all of our website and on-location live streams. They are your home for unlimited, that's right, unlimited high-speed internet for all and for your whole family. Stop by, check them out. I have been using them for months, pretty much since the rebrand to Curious Realm. And I'm here to tell you, I put up a lot of content. I've yet to be throttled. Stop on by. Check it out. WebWorksWireless.com. While you're there, make sure to stop on by and check out the great work of our other sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge at Secret to Everything. She is your source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion. SecretToEverything.com is the website. Stop on by and check her out. In this segment, we are going to be talking with our good friend Daniel Allen Jones from The Vortex. We actively just saw him at the Bigfoot Roadshow. We were both so busy. He was busy emceeing the event. I was busy doing live stream. And though we got to cross paths, we didn't really get to have him on. And I was like, we're going to have you on really soon. I guarantee it. I've got some road stuff coming up. But sure enough, while I was on the road, just a few days ago, Sol 3466 from the mass camera on the Mars rover came out, and this is a pretty incredible picture. Let me enlarge this a little bit so that you can see what it's all about. This looks very much like what we would consider to be almost like a tomb entrance on Earth. And when I saw this, the first thing I thought was, I think I found my topic for Daniel Allen Jones. Welcome back to the show, my friend. How are you doing today?
Hey, Chris, doing well. It's good to be back. This is kind of an interesting time. And, you know, with all these events going on, it's pretty synchronous, I think, for this photo to have here become viral in the last several days, with especially as we were talking before, just with the UAP hearing coming up in Congress. And I think it's timely, and it'll be interesting to see maybe how that comes into play, if it does at all. But it's been great to have gotten together here recently, as you mentioned, back at the event in Mineola. So it's you know, there's a lot going on with that sort of thing, and I'm glad we had time to cross paths and meet up. So those are awesome. I really enjoy those events, and I hope that we can continue to have more of those. But yeah, I'm glad to be here, and it's an interesting topic for sure.
Yeah, most definitely. It's one of those that, and of course, I'm a geology freak. I've always got my rocks and minerals behind me. I have cabinets of rocks and minerals out front. You know, I'm willing to let natural geology explain a lot of things for anyone who might say, like, well, you know, things don't grow in right angles in nature. Well, I challenge you to take a look at a really nice piece of fluorite or a really nice piece of pyrite. They tend to grow in precise cubes when in the perfect environment. And though you can get right angles, things like that, the image that has been put out by NASA definitely looks more like this has been carved out. It doesn't look like it's a complete tunnel or anything like that, but the rock definitely does not look like it's grown that way. It looks like it has been cut out that way.
It's definitely catching a lot of attention online. It's something that I think people are equating to some kind of cave tomb or this maybe an artifact that has been made at some point in the distant past. And I think that aside from if there are any natural explanations, I think that there have been a few proposed by a few individuals. I think that it implies a lot to think that maybe if in the event that this or something else that we eventually can come across is found to be an artificial construction, some kind of structure or artifact that whoever has made, which is another interesting, you know, idea. That, I think, gives a lot of incentive to look into this from something that we can call astroarchaeology or exoarchaeology, xenoarchaeology. And this is basically dealing with structures that could be found in other places in the universe, you know, in other worlds that weren't necessarily made by people, you know, here on Earth. And I think that's an interesting notion to think that, you know, if there are civilizations out there that are advanced in our technological in any capacity like our own, then I think that that should be something that we can probably make detections of. And we're obviously making some efforts to try to do that. And I think what's interesting is to find shapes, patterns, sequences in nature. We do that here. And as you mentioned, you know, a lot of times people have this idea that there aren't any right angles in nature or something to that effect. And like you pointed out, I mean, we do have a lot of really incredible things going on that nature is capable of. I think that people are discounting of nature, unfortunately, in a way that we think, oh, that's, it can't be done. And I think that sometimes nature can do way beyond incredible things that we wouldn't expect it to sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
And surpasses our expectation. But in the case of something like this, you know, some people have said, well, what's the scale? And I think some numbers have mentioned that maybe it's only 3 or so feet tall. And the interesting thing about that is that, of course, which comes with that, the rhetoric that some have actually said, even scientists said, well, I guess that means that Martians really were like little green men or really small, you know? So it's kind of a fun idea that I think, you know, sometimes gets dismissed, but actually opens the doors to more scientific opportunity.
It certainly does match that popular trope of the gray, you know, the between 3.5, 4 feet tall, something like that. And once again, when you look at this picture, folks, I am more apt to debunk than to accept, Daniel. And we have had this conversation more than once, as the great Carl Sagan would say, with a great claim comes a greater need of evidence, you know, and the demand on the evidence is bigger. And I think it's definitely something that needs to be explored. There is definitely a huge shadow coming down inside the image. Whenever you blow it up, you can see the shadow from the sun on one side, and that's how you can tell it's not entirely too deep. Like, you can see the back of the carving, you can see the back of it, but if it is a carving, so to speak, but it definitely, I don't know, with the type of wind erosion and everything else that's there, you would kind of expect to see the same kind of erosion even inside of that structure if it was something that was natural and was, you know, hewn that way by nature. You would see the same kind of erosion inside that you do on the outside. And that's not really the case here. It looks as though it's smooth. It looks as though it has been cut out of that eroded rock, whenever you look at the side right here, things like that. Now, this is just coming at it as someone who spent some time in the Rocks and Minerals Club, cutting rocks, you know, with a rock saw, things like that. This is just my limited experience as a rocks and minerals fiend and collector. But it definitely looks like something happened there. Not like it is a perfectly natural structure.
Yeah, I think it catches a lot of attention because of how similar it might appear to some of these ancient ruins we see here on Earth. And I think that if we even had the opportunity to detect any of these types of structures, these potential constructs made by other people, you know, in the universe or wherever else it is, in this case, maybe on Mars at one point, it's interesting to consider that while a lot of other organizations like NASA's SETI are looking to try to find radio waves and different forms of bands of frequency and things that are way out in deep space, because the likeliness of detecting something like a physical structure out there right now is very improbable just because of our ability to see that far. And so I think that obviously with close planets, especially Mars or even the moon, if we are, you know, able to find things like that, that's probably going to be the most likely opportunity for us to see physical structure rather than to detect deep space radio frequencies. And so the interesting part about all of this is that the idea of structures on both the moon and in this case, especially Mars, is not a new concept, because people have claimed that there are structures on both of these celestial bodies. And I think that that's something that, while it has been widely dismissed in some circles and mainly the mainstream scientific circles, in other alternative communities and people who are at least open-minded enough to see that there is there are discussions on this, that you have things that go back to what some refer to as the face on Mars.
Absolutely.
And Cydonia, and all of these different patterns which people, you know, try to make sense of in a way that seems to express a form of geometry or sequence, yeah, and ratio that is maybe, you know, more common in nature than most realize. And this idea that maybe there are these sort of pyramids on Mars, or obelisks on the moon, and or all of these other things that maybe we're trying to relate to something that we've seen here, that people have done, that we have, our ancestors have done, in the distant past. And I think that maybe there's this interesting idea because of the lore and the mythology behind a lot of ancient astronaut theory, and just the modern scientific direction of, is it possible to find and detect any of these things if they exist? And how that may bridge together can show us that, okay, if all of these stories, or if at least any of them, have some kind of confirmation that we can detect by way of, you know, discovering these structures on another planet, my next idea might be, well, even aside from any super top secret classified black projects that could get us there and back or whatever in some amount of time, or have some kind of clandestine, you know, group go out there, let's say in the most conventional sense that this structure or one like it is found and then publicized all over media, the internet. We said, okay, then what do we do to get people there if we do it all? You know, if we look at what NASA or SpaceX or any of these types of big space industry companies are doing, it would seem like it would take years for us to even tangibly send anything out next to, you know, having people would be astronomically longer, because, you know, this whole idea, I think, gets at this whole reason why we even know about this in the first place, which is because of the Curiosity rover, which, yeah, is there because people can't seem to be there according to what we're, you know, shown and told, and what's conventionally available. It seems like we probably wouldn't be able to get people, you know, boots on the ground in the field, so to speak, to examine it for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Although if we do have the technology to do it sort of behind closed doors, I think that that's something we have to consider, that if this is made public, you can only imagine what isn't. And if there has been something discovered in a way that's like this, that, I mean, maybe there have been expeditions like that taking place this whole time, that, you know, would be one of the most incredible parts of our hidden reality. But I think that that's, you know, getting into the realm of speculation. But sure, with what we're seeing here, if this is a real object, in the sense of it being artificial and all of this, it's hard to say how we could proceed in a tangible way that can, you know, extrapolate more data or information from that area, other than taking more pictures from the same rover, you know, and any effort to try to get people up there, just for that, I think is a good idea. But also, it's like there are probably other reasons why they'd want to get people up there first. I think that would be a good reason too, if not anything else, you know, to try to make sense of, okay, if we find something that's definitely not made by humans, at least that we know of in modern times, that's like a world-changing event. And I think that that's something that, of course, you know, it stratifies our strife here on the planet. But I think that, you know, that's why people say, well, why would we want to go to outer space and Mars when we still have hunger and all of these other things too? So I think that's something we have to consider.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And that's actually the premise of the whole movie Red Planet. If you remember, that's what they start out with, is going to this place that they found on Mars from a rover, and then things go haywire. but what this reminds me a lot of is actively the work of Richard C. Hoagland, especially when you start bringing up Cydonia, and the Cydonia complex. There was the long-held theory by Richard C. Not even was, still long-held theory by Richard C. Hoagland, that it is an intelligently made complex on the surface of Mars. That is where, of course, the face of Mars was first photographed. And when you look at it, all kinds of polygonal structures, pentagonal structures, hexagonal structures, many things that look from the air akin to the bent pyramid of Khufu on Earth, things like that. So the once again, like you said, the idea of might we find something, might we come across technology of either a lost civilization or a civilization that has relocated? Sure, definitely within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I can recall an interview with Hoagland, who had mentioned being in the control room at NASA with Carl Sagan, and he had said that at one point when they were looking at early renditions of the surface and of the landscape, that basically they were given orders to change the hue and saturation of the imaging quality to go from a nice sort of a pale blue sky to a reddish, dirty, you know, brown type of coloration. And it's interesting to think of if that's actually in everything he says is true, then a lot has been changed and doctored before it ever reaches the public. And it makes you wonder, I think that there are probably some decent reasons as to why there has to be image editing to, you know, get a nice, good picture. But at the same time, that seems like that's kind of a different direction. That's almost like concealing some kind of, you know, imaging or something that otherwise could be very different than what we're told. And I think that maybe if, as you had mentioned, with the structures that he talks about, that could be a really big deal. And it makes you wonder, okay, if that is true and they discovered these pyramidal structures, and then there's a lot of geometry and the ratios between all of these structures shows some kind of connection with intelligence and maybe intelligent design by someone, some civilization or something. You would think that maybe, why would America not want to say, hey, we discovered, you know, ancient ruins and we're going to go up there and set the flag down and say we did it first. You know, it seems like the really American type of thing
to
do.
That is the
total
American thing to do.
But it's not happened. That makes us wonder, you know, in the case of something like this, what is the agenda? Or if something does finally become not discredited and not debunked and not falsified, what do we really do? And I don't know if there's something set in place for that to happen because of how intangible it seems outside of sending more robotics, you know, and that might be what we have to do for now.
Well, this is one of those prime examples. Richard C. Hoagland is a dream interview of mine. I have followed his work for years and years and years, and to see the way that science has literally driven him out because of these theorems. And that's all that they are. They are theorems. And that's how we get science. You know, you have to be willing to think outside of the box. You have to be willing to accept what may not fit your paradigm. And at the very least, explore the possibility. And I have always lauded him for that. And with his work on Cydonia and things like that, I think it's the fact of he might be striking a little too close to home for a lot of people in science to be able to accept.
That's right. I think it's one of those issues where if, you know, just I think as Sagan pointed out, and if he was privy to all of this as well, who had, you know, for anyone that follows or has known about or heard about Richard Hoagland's work, that pales compared to the likeness of someone like Sagan, who, as you mentioned earlier, you know, with even what we know as the Sagan standard, with these, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And right. I think that that's something that, let's say, okay, if he was there and he was aware of these things at NASA as well, then it would be a real challenge for him to, if, I mean, and of course, some people think of him as somewhat of like a denier, a debunker. I think that he's probably the biggest proponent of extraterrestrial life, probably more than almost anyone else, just because of how much of a popularizer of that. But aside from that, I think he scrutinized things in a way that I think has to be when you're funded by a lot of these different institutions or agencies or or in any official capacity to also, you know, share certain information and to not share other information. I think and that's maybe what we're dealing with, because there's a lot of conjecture about things that he had said off the record about, you know, if only the people actually knew, you know, what all the stuff that's really going on and what they're hiding and all of this. And of course, sure. You know, that's a little bit of rhetoric, but I think it's one of those things that I think that you have to consider that if someone like Sagan was also privy to this, that, you know, he's holding back a, you know, a floodgate of just all of this information that maybe he was told not to discuss in any way publicly. And that makes you wonder, yeah. You know, with all the stuff that he could say and he did say, what maybe, you know, is left there in the haystack, you know, where we might be able to find those needles.
Yeah.
Of truth, so to speak. And I think it's interesting to think of someone like that or Hoagland or any of these people who've known yeah. about the Mars research for a long time, because well, most people now only know about it because Elon Musk wants to go there, you know? Yeah. And so that's another challenge is that we lose information over time.
And most people only know about it now because of the work of these people. And it's sad to see, I mean, you yourself, were very good friends with the late, great Jim Mars. There is quite a bit about the JFK assassination that we would not know were it not for the work of Jim Mars. And that's the sad thing, is that we know the information, but we tend to forget the source. And so many times, especially whenever you're talking about people coming through with testimony, people coming through with, hey, this is what's been happening for a long time. Someone like Richard C. Hoagland was there with the Viking programs. You know, he was there when we first landed on Mars, when we were first making the passes to go past Mars. And he had been ringing this bell for a long, long time. And to know that now we are getting to the fact of considering these things, we are getting to the fact of looking into things greater, and with what you may or may not think, folks, about the face on Mars, things like that. The arrangement of these things in the Cydonia region and the shape of them, things like that, are strange. They're interesting. And they definitely, I think, no different than any placement of standing stones on Earth or something like that, which may point to something. What if this does as well? What if this was something left, even if not by a civilization that is previously us, what have you, but as a warning or a message of some sort from somebody, no different than a Nazca line or anything like that. Fully within the realm of possibility, and I think fully within the realm of needing to be researched. I don't think that Carl Sagan disbelieved in the potential for alien life. He would not have put the effort into the Voyager discs that he put in if he didn't believe. That's just my own personal thought form on folks like Carl Sagan, Richard C. Hoagland, what they've done for the cause of this research, and what they've done to help literally ring the bells of science to say, at the very least, we need to investigate, we need to explore and do the work of science. So,
right, and I think that it's really important to see that, you know, if in the best possible scenario, let's say, you know, this is whatever we're witnessing here that's been publicized now for a little while, it's making the rounds online, it's getting people's attention on different social media networks and platforms. And there are already several ideas sprung up of what this is and what it could be. Not necessarily by the scientific community, just by people making observations. So, you know, we can tell that people are interested in running with a lot of these ideas of it's got to be something real and that maybe it shows signs of life and intelligence. And if that were the case, we can speak in hypotheticals and maybe say so best case possibility would be that this is a real structure let's say a tomb, if we call it that at all, let's say it's that, and not only, or maybe let's say not a tomb, it's an active facility, even better. I mean, if we went there and we found that it was a real structure and there was a real alien in there, that would be the best possible scenario. The next best thing would be to go there, find out it's somewhat of what we would call a tomb, and there's the remains of something organic or tangible. Next to it being alive, that's the best we can kind of go with. And from there, you know, it's like, okay, if there's not an actual body or remains, then we just find out, okay, someone designed this. That's curious as well. But, you know, it's helpful when we find, let's say, structures here on Earth, and then we find bodies associated or the remains of people associated with those structures. We can kind of infer an attempt to interpret the history, because a lot of archaeology is an attempt to interpret the past based upon physical remains, physical anthropology.
Yeah.
And it's really trying to help fill in the gaps of what we know that's been documented versus what we're finding. And so sometimes it's not always that what we think happened actually happened. We're just trying to piece it together based upon the best available information. And the most likely circumstance may be, this is Occam's razor, which is, it could just be a pile of fallen rocks or something. And I think that, sure, that of course makes sense, but it's not nearly as an exciting explanation for anyone. Of course, everyone wants it to be these ancient ruins of an alien civilization that could, yeah, show us, oh, there are forms and signs of life. And guess what? It's not way, way out there. I mean, it could be, but it's right here in our own solar neighborhood, so to speak. And I think it's something that if we have that and we can find that out and we're already sharing it with the world, that should tell us something, that what has been found out that isn't, that has maybe enough of a seriousness to it by official, you know, organizations and agencies, militaries, things like that, that are actually looking at stuff under defense secrecy, that can't just outright share it with the world because of, you know, the secrecy issue. And I think that makes you wonder, okay, if we're sharing stuff like this and amateur astronomers, and that people think like all, you know, that there are a lot of ideas on astronomy and all this stuff, but astronomy is not one huge working body of unified people. I mean, you have a group like NASA, but you also have all these other independent space agencies and amateur astronomers and people who are trying to do this work from all angles. It's not all, a concerted effort that I think seems to all like have a, the same idea. And it's the same with science in general as well. People kind of have this idea that, oh, science says and does this, and it's not really like that. But I think that if you look at the general overview of the knowledge base that we have of the universe, according to what we're told and the data that we're finding, you know, there's a lot going on and, yeah, in the galaxy and the solar system and all of these things that show, okay, we're finding out new things all the time, and the possibility for life out there is, being the attempt to try to determine and calculate that is an ongoing updating sort of formula. And sometimes that's been referred to the Drake equation,
sure,
you know, to try to ascertain the number of advanced intelligent civilizations. And I think that if we somehow were to find that right here, not just way out there in the universe, but like right here, literally next door to us, that should tell us something that maybe, I mean, there's probably a connection. It's hard to say that, you know, we were to find that aliens live right next door to us here, but somehow after all, there's no connection at all. And we haven't found anything in the rest of the universe ever, but we just happen to find something right next to us. I think that there's gotta be something that would show that, okay, if we're finding something that close, we need to really revisit the past, revisit what people were telling us. I think is a really good example. A lot of people really find the notion of ancient aliens or paleo contact, yeah, what we call ancient astronaut theory, really interesting and entertaining because of, you know, media and things now. But one of the biggest proponents outside of Eric von Däniken was Zechariah Sitchin, who's no longer with us, but he wrote a series called The Earth Chronicles, which talked about Nibiru and the Anunnaki. And I think it's one of those things that you have to see is a big reason why a lot of these ideas were popularized. But he basically tried to translate these ancient Sumerian Mesopotamian tablets and texts that talked about these Anunnaki gods who came and basically started humanity coming from their own planet, which they called Nibiru, and they used this other nearby planet, which he referred to as Mars, as a sort of waypoint to Earth. And if that all is true, and obviously there are some people who are very dismissive of his claims, but let's just say for the sake of this concept that if any of that or anything like what he's suggesting is true at any point in our earthly history, that there's a connection to Mars in the distant past, then maybe some of those things are still detectable, just as we find ancient remains of civilization here on Earth. Mm. I think that maybe if Mars is as Earth-like, or Earth is as Mars-like, maybe as we're told and shown,
sure.
Because all the things that we learn about Mars keep continuing to kind of develop toward this idea of it once being very similar to Earth, rather than it being this sort of desolate, desert of rocks all the time, that maybe at one point it had oceans and waterways that we can maybe find traces of now. Anyway, I think that it's really important to see that if any of these ancient stories are true and it have any connection to Mars, then maybe some of these things are still out there intangible and awaiting our discovery, in a way to really be something that can otherwise change the world and our understanding of what's yeah. been going on this whole time and maybe who we are. And I think there's a lot to that that helps us see that science in this direction, while oftentimes is something that most people are, who look into this stuff or could be dismissive of, I think could probably be the most helpful thing for us to really bring these ideas into the public awareness in the most effective way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I was showing up on screen just a minute ago, and I'll show it now in a little bit greater detail. But you did get to handle what you needed to handle, right, Daniel?
We're all good. Yeah, we're good.
Good. I was showing up on screen just a minute ago, a close-up of this, quote, portal on Mars. And what I was flipping to was actually the portal de Aramu in Peru, and which is like an unfinished doorway carved into the rock in Machu Picchu. So interesting, kind of a similar motif there going on with the fact of if it is something carved, then it was unfinished, or if it was finished, then perhaps it was made to represent that whole unfinished concept. And I think that we as people, period, have a tendency to anthropomorphize things, have a tendency to, and I was just having this conversation with somebody in Orlando, and the fact of it is very naive of us, and Stephen Hawking was a huge, huge proponent of this, it is naive of us to anthropomorphize aliens and think that, well, sure, we're aspiring to peace as a species. Why wouldn't they? They're more technologically advanced. Wouldn't we be better to each other and more peaceful the more technologically advanced we get, like in Star Trek? Well, that might be us, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the aliens are like that. You know?
I think that it's something that even in the scientific community, there's a big division.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, Hawking had a very specific viewpoint, whereas someone else maybe, not necessarily on the other end, but like somewhere on these, areas of of interest or ideas or opinions, Sagan would have been sort of on the other persuasion of maybe we need to try to contact alien life and try to figure this out, whereas Hawking was an adamant opposer of any sort of attempt at contact for good reason. I think there are both valid reasons for both of those ideas. Sure. But I think, as you mentioned, it's something that we do anthropomorphize these ideas because we've always done that. And the concept, I think, of what we see in the ancient past with these deities that were told are from the stars and the sky people, and they come down and they're the mothers and fathers of humanity.
Yeah.
and they come from these places and they did these things in the heavens. And granted, a lot of that could just be something that if to most people just say, well, that's just a fun story that they made up to tell people. Okay, if most people think that, or most people have this idea of mythology and religion and how maybe some things can be historically based or not, the premise, I think, of the progenitor theory, I guess, is something that really you have to weigh in. If these people were humanoid and they were in some form bipedal and what we understand to be sort of human in the sense of what we are, I think that makes you wonder, or should make anyone wonder, if there's any truth to any of that, or if there's any reality or factuality to any of that, then we should probably be able to find evidence or make detections of that actuality. And I think that's something that challenges the idea of like what Stephen Hawking was also getting at, is that, you know, we have no business, and this is basically like what you're saying, that he would think and others do, they think that we have no business trying to, make into this human idea anything that's alien, because it probably is not. And that might be the case, that we could find life out there that's totally, has a total different morphology and biology that we think. And that's why I think that the whole idea of like an unknown biology is really an important part of what we can learn about here, because a lot of what we find, really, we are finding subspecies of major families of animal groups. It's not often that we find something totally offshoot from like main core animal families. And I think that's something that, you know, is a possibility, but we have kind of now at this point figured out a lot about what's here in our own biome. And I think that if we look at what's possible in other cosmological biomes that have their own forms of light and frequency and their own sort of planetary resonance that they have to live within, life could be much different. But at the same time, you know, there are these ideas that have been purported that, you know, maybe humanoid life is not just this weird thing that's happened here, like happenstance, very rare, but it could be a commonality. And that's obviously a curious thought to consider. Okay, if all these other people around the world in ancient times were saying the same thing and they made depictions of that.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, maybe some of them were anthropomorphized, but maybe some of them were literal representations. And we have to think, okay, if we don't just are not immediately dismissive of that, that maybe there's something to that. And if we find this stuff out there, like these doorways that seem to be, you know, showing, okay, that there could be something out there, then maybe we need to also look at the other possible ways that this has been expressed in both modern and ancient times.
Yeah, precisely. And how those cross over, how they, because, One of the concepts that I bring up regularly on the show, Daniel, is imagine being that alien civilization that has been. The only thing you have is our transmissions. You have zero frame of reference as to where they come from or how they originated. You're just getting all of our radio and TV and everything that's been broadcast since the beginning of broadcast. And it almost becomes, I know you're right up around the same age as me, but I don't know if you're as hip deep in the pop culture of the 80s. But if you remember the movie The Voyagers, where the kids build the little spaceship and they go up, and these aliens that they meet talk like in TV. Everything that they talk about is TV and radio and things like that. And how much of an influence would that have on any culture traveling for light years to get here? You know, like that would literally be, unless they happened across the space probe that had the golden discs on it that gave them some Chuck Berry and stuff, you know, or happened across